I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. An NCAA recruiting scandal last year involving the University of Kansas resulted in prison time for three former Adidas executives. Then last month, the university announced a multi-million dollar renewal of its contract with the company. Today, what can KU and Adidas do to help prevent future basketball scandals? We'll discuss the extended agreement, how the university will spend $196 million, and what happened to the players caught up in the scheme. Then, emergency dispatchers are in a high-stress job that can literally mean life or death. We'll talk with a 28-year veteran about her work as a 911 operator. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If you recently did a double take over the University of Kansas's nearly $200 million contract with Adidas, you're hardly alone. Commentators and fans are asking the question, wasn't Adidas the company that got KU into hot water with its recruiting program to begin with? The answer, yes, it was. It was Adidas that got KU entangled in an FBI investigation that cast a negative light on the university's athletic programs. The contract, this renewed contract, is for 14 years. It's worth $196 million to KU. The rub? It still remains unclear what Adidas will do to help prevent a future basketball scandal at KU. With us here to talk about this is Chad Lawhorn. He's the publisher and editor of the Lawrence Journal World, who's written about this issue. He joins us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Chad, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Michael Watson's also back. He's a retired pro athlete who played his college ball at UMKC. He's now a motivational speaker and founder of Mentality. He's also a host of the ESPN show The W. Michael, nice to have you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Chad, it's not hard to wonder what's going on here. Adidas got KU in trouble. Now KU's extending its contract with the company for 14 years and a whole lot of money. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, from a reporter's standpoint, the key question I've been trying to get answered and write about is, what have you learned from Adidas about how this happened? How did three employees or consultants of yours end up getting convicted on fraud charges? And what steps have the company taken to ensure that doesn't happen in the future?
And you can't get an answer to that question,
no,
can you?
No, all we get right now is that, you know, the chancellor and the athletic director have done lots of due diligence, but then when you ask what that due diligence includes, you get no specifics. So that's pretty noteworthy, I think.
Michael, what do you make of it?
I mean, it's the business of college basketball. I think you're getting an opportunity to see it firsthand. A lot of people just kind of hear about it and it kind of goes away. But with this has been going on for years, ever since the beginning of big shoe deals like Nike, Adidas, even back to Converse and Puma, when those guys started back in the late 70s, early 80s, and Nike has just taken over now Adidas as well. But that's the business of college basketball, along with the TV contracts. You have to have money from these shoe companies to make your engine run.
$196 million, Michael? I mean,
oh, yeah.
We're talking the same company that got KU in hot water to begin with. Does that make sense? I mean, couldn't they gone with a different company?
You could have gone with a different company, but then you lose those relationships and those ties. And then you also run the risk of bringing up other old dirt that could possibly be there by trying to switch. So it's always somebody who you're holding the foot to the fire when it's deals like that being made.
You know, a commentator for Yahoo Sports wrote this about KU's agreement with Adidas. He wrote, "That's not standard operating procedure on the part of an entity that sincerely believes it was defrauded and damaged. It is, however, standard shameless procedure in college athletics. Actually, this is close to peak shamelessness." Does he have a point, Chad?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what's going to be important is to see what's to come of this. I mean, there's been a lot made of, is KU a victim in this? Is KU not a victim in this? I don't know that the feds have done a great job of articulating that. I think KU fans are going to feel like they're a victim if the NCAA here in the near future puts a postseason ban on KU or reduces their scholarships available. And in some regards, that's really what the NCAA was saying when it said KU is a victim here. You you have had things happen under your watch that will subject you to NCAA penalties, perhaps, and you're going to be a victim when you get the penalty, when you get the penalties that come with that. In terms of whether KU should be in business with shoe companies, clearly it's the norm, but it's really not for me to make a judgment about whether higher education should be wrapped up in that, but it's definitely an issue that's fascinating to write about.
You know, Michael Watson, again, he's host of the W Show on ESPN Radio. Is KU the victim here?
No.
How do you look at this?
Not at all. No one's the victim. No big school like that, KU, Duke, Arizona. These schools are not the victim. They know what's going on. Everyone knows what's going on because you have to pay to play. And it's been going on for years. This isn't anything new. Now that the feds have gotten
involved.
So
you're saying that every big school does this, paying to play is standard operating procedure.
You better believe it. If anybody tells you otherwise, they're not being real with you. I mean, it's just you can't get these big name guys to go because it starts before college. It starts in the AAU, 9th, 10th grade. You have these AAU programs who are funded by these shoe companies, and that they want their guys to go to those schools. So that's why you get Adidas players from Adidas teams and the Gauntlet and Nike EYBL and those players who end up going to colleges who have the same shoe companies and that the AAU played for. So it's nothing new. I mean, people are acting surprised, but it's really nothing new.
Well, I thought the NCAA was supposed to be policing this stuff, Michael, and those of us who are fans of college basketball, I think a lot of people do sort of sit back and think, hey, you know, it's being policed, these players are not being paid, and you're telling me something very different.
Well,
here.
It's like if you have two prisoners and one goes and tells the warden, are they not still two prisoners? So you have the NCAA, who's to me one of the biggest crooks around in the way they treat players and don't pay them any money but have a $1 billion TV deal. But then you want to go and be mad at these players for taking $10,000 and $20,000 and $50,000 to help their families when you're making billions of dollars off of their back and off of their likeness throughout March and April.
Yeah.
So who's the real crook here is what I think.
Chad, what do you think of what Michael just said?
Well, I think, one, it's not a victimless crime. I think folks have conflated the athletic department as being the university in its entirety. There's more to the university than just the athletic department. And so the actions that may happen will have an impact on things other than just the athletic department. One of the real difficulties in this case is the victim. There's a face to that victim, there's a name to that victim, but we don't know who it is. Because think of it this way. There are a finite number of college basketball scholarships available in the U.S. Let's just say, for instance, it's 500. I can guarantee you there's more than 500 kids that want a full-ride college basketball scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
We right now know of, just at KU, two people that were occupying full-ride college basketball scholarships that weren't eligible to have them. So there's two people out there, we don't know who they are, we don't know their names, that didn't get the benefit of that. And maybe their lives are changed because, you know, maybe they didn't go to college at all because they didn't get that full ride college basketball scholarship. So there's real victims here. It's just tough to identify them. And I think that what has surprised everybody is that the feds have stepped in here and said, we're interested enough in this to do something about it. And now the NCAA has quite a decision to make. They've got to make, is the world going to change for us or not? Are we going to make a more sincere effort to police this? Are we going to make a more sincere effort to prevent this? And the question that's on the minds of lots of KU fans is, are we going to make an example of a few folks that have done this? And right now, you know, the low-hanging fruit is all the programs that have been brought up in the federal trial, because the NCAA is going through the process of getting that evidence, and they won't have to go reprove it again. It was like, it was already proved in court. We're going to take this evidence and make our findings based off of that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR this morning. We're talking about KU's new nearly $200 million shoe contract with Adidas. That's the same shoe company that got the program in trouble in recent months. Michael, how vigorously does the NCAA investigate programs like KU and all programs on an ongoing basis? Are these folks tough, or is this just sort of a cursory checking the box kind of thing?
No, I think the gentleman just spoke on it perfectly when he said that since the feds got involved, now you have to look like you're being tough on it. But really what it's going to make the NCAA do is going to make them open up more to having to pay these players, because it's really not anything that doesn't happen in baseball or soccer. When you're coming out of high school, you're getting paid to play. You're getting paid to play at 18 years old. And so the one and done rule will have to be taken out with the NBA probably. So they'll have to now conform to the times. NCAA is like the old man in the room, and they want to stay and keep things the way they are because they're beneficial to the NCAA. They're not beneficial to the players. And now those things that are coming out, it's going to burst the seams and let the NCAA and everyone around it know, hey, no, you got to pay this money to these players or these institutions because they're going to get it anyway. And since you don't want to say you're breaking the rules, now you got to change the rules. Now you got to change the rules around your game so that now these things aren't illegal.
How soon do you think that big change, that seismic shift in college sports is coming?
Within the next year.
You're saying.
You saw a couple of years ago with how they changed the NCAA, the open periods for recruiting in the summers. That was a direct response to these allegations that have come out. So they changed them and shortened them up and put them in a certain month. It used to be the entire summer. Now you can only do it a couple of weeks here and a couple of weeks here. So they're trying to scramble and make adjustments. And so you're going to see when these findings come out, within the next year, 2 years at most, they're going to start changing a lot of these rules. You're going to see they may not call them, you know, salaries, but they may call them a healthy stipend. You already get stipends on scholarship, but it'll be a lot more than what, you know, the guys are receiving now.
Chad Lawhorn, again, publisher and editor of the Lawrence Journal World. What's the latest in this scandal over in Lawrence? I mean, how much danger is there today that KU and Coach Bill Self are going to get dragged into this thing even more than they've already been dragged into it?
Well, I think, you know, from a legal standpoint, we don't see storm clouds on the horizon that Bill Self or his staff's going to get brought into this trial that's going on right now, for instance. I think clearly the watch is from on the NCAA front in terms of there's clearly an investigation underway right now. I mean, and what type of penalties may come from that? I think that KU faces significant risk of being penalized for some of the things that came out during the trial. I mean, Bill Self was having some pretty specific conversations with T.J. Gasnola at Curtis Townsend.
He's the Adidas executive who's at the heart of this whole thing, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Curtis Townsend, the assistant basketball coach at KU, had some pretty interesting conversations with Merle Code, who has been convicted in this case as well. And so the question becomes, was Adidas being more than just an apparel provider for the university, was it also providing recruiting assistance to the University of Kansas? And I think the NCAA rules say that you can't have that type of recruiting assistance from an organization like Adidas.
But Michael Watson, you're saying this is par for the course.
Gosh, yes. Yeah, no one is surprised except the people who don't want to see it. And if you're a KU fan, Arizona fan, Duke fan, North Carolina fan, because everybody's implicated. It's a lot of the bluegrass schools that are implicated, not only in this trial, but have implicated before. So if you don't want to see it, you won't see it. But everyone knows that players are being paid or being funneled to those schools.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, Michael. And there was coverage in the ongoing stories about KU's involvement here about Zion Williamson, who's going to be the number one pick in the NBA draft, college basketball player of the year as a freshman, I think. The story sort of suggested that the rumors out in the underground world of college basketball was that if you wanted to recruit Zion Williamson, you were going to have to pay and offer a job to his grandfather or his father. I forget exactly what it was. But again,
right?
You know, this was out there pretty broadly. Should I be surprised?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that you know what's coming when you're dealing with a once-in-a-generational player like Zion Williamson. You know what's coming with him. And that's not to say that those things happen, but it's par for the course, like you said. If you're going to get this guy who's the next LeBron James, you know, being touted as such, you know he's going to come with something. It's going to cost you something. And so, but the thing about the whole NCAA and these big shoe companies and these big colleges is they're too big to fail. So when you have these colleges and universities who are being caught up on these charges or whatever, they're too big to fail. So we have to figure out a loophole and a way to work around it, because this is going to mess up our engine that is the NCAA.
You know, if folks out there listening to what you're saying this morning, Michael, are thinking to themselves, this is disgusting, you would say what to that?
Is it? Is it disgusting? Because the same thing happens in golf, and it's not disgusting. In tennis, and it's not disgusting. Soccer, baseball.
In every sport.
In every sport except basketball. These kids can play and get paid and earn a wage for their work that they're due.
How do those other sports get
paid?
But
wait. Doesn't – I mean, they can go get paid right now if they want, right? They just need to do it through the G League, not through college basketball.
Right, and it's a great point. So what you said, and that's a response. That was a knee-jerk reaction by the NBA and the NCAA who tried to work together to try to offset what they really need to do in paying these players.
You're losing me here. So you're talking – just break it down 101 here so that if you want to get paid, what is the D League and how does that work?
So the G League, it used to be called the NBA Developmental League.
Right.
So NBA Developmental League was an entity that's been contrived by the NBA to have it's basically like a farm league, like in baseball. So you send your players there who don't want to attend college, but that's only two years old. That's just happened in the last 2 years with the G League. Before that, the D League was the farm system. So you still had to go through college or play a year of college, or you had to go overseas and play for a year. You couldn't play in the NBA because of the age regulation. You had to play 1 year of college or be 1 year removed from high school. So that's the difference. And like I said, the last couple of years, they've had to change. So they put little things in place to try to look like they're trying to be progressive. And in actuality, they're still trying to protect their bottom line.
Our phone
the
number.
Solutions,
yeah, go ahead, Chad.
The solution's really simple. I mean, the system's in place in baseball. I mean, kids don't go to college and play baseball and get paid. They go to the minor league system and get paid. The NBA, when they are creating a minor league system for basketball, kids that want to go that route that have no interest in getting a college degree can go that route. I think that's been some of the pushback from the higher education community on why you don't pay these players is because, hey, let's remember how this started. It started is that we think that providing extracurricular athletic activity aids in your education. And now all of a sudden it's grown over decades into a situation where we're giving scholarships to kids that don't have any interest in getting a degree. They say that up front. That's not the way it works with most scholarships. Scholarships are a valuable thing.
Right, but how much money are the athletic programs kick in that don't all go to athletics as well, so that people in higher education have to understand that it's a lot of kickback that's being benefited by from higher education that doesn't go to athletics. So the Dukes, North, those big schools are generating money and generating players and interest from not players, students who want to come to that school because their programs are doing well.
Right.
So at KU, the general fund provides Kansas athletics $1.5 million every year. So there's been a lot of debate up here on the Hill.
That's chump change.
But it's a million. What the problem is that the general campus is undergoing a $20 million budget cut right now. So they were like, well, you know, let's maybe not have the $1.5 million go out of the general operating fund over to KU Athletics that is generating $100 million on its own.
Chad, right. Let me slow you down. So you're saying that even though KU is getting $196 million from Adidas over the next number of years, there's still money from the general fund that has to go into the higher into the athletic fund?
Yeah, it's about $1 million, $1.5 million.
I mean,
yeah, but the athletic budget is somewhere around $65 million.
No, it's about $100 million.
We'll see. Yeah.
That's so how, why that's do you need money from the general fund then, Chad? If you're getting so much money from the shoe company.
Well, that's been a key point that the faculty has
that's
raised.
That's what faculty are saying.
They don't need it.
Yeah.
But the problem that KU Athletics has, and the other reason some folks would argue against paying players, is that people that really look into the finances of college athletics, what they'll tell you is the last thing college athletics needs right now is more expenses, because college athletics does not have a revenue problem, but it has a spending problem. From 2006 to 2017, the revenues for Kansas athletics grew by 68%. That's a nice chunk of increase. Its expenses grew by 93%. People that understand business will tell you that's not sustainable.
What's the money being spent on, Chad? Where's that money going?
Well, coaches, travel, lots of administrative staff. I mean, KU has over, I think, you know, off the top of my head, $13-14 million in payroll of administrative staff members in the athletic department.
Let me slow you both down. I got a phone call I want to grab here. Josh from Lawrence. Josh, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking the call. Great discussion and really interested in the specific focus on KU recently. But my question was kind of going back to the Adidas scandal. James Gatto, who was convicted, found guilty of this, you know, money payment to Fanny Foulmanger, Sylvia DeSosa's caregiver. I think that's his name. He got sentenced to 6 months. Sylvia DeSosa, who by all appearances didn't know that any money had changed hands, and remember that the amount we're talking is $2,500, he has to sit out 2 seasons. Now, this is a kid who came from Angola to play basketball and hopefully make it to the NBA one day. That the proportionality between the two consequences there doesn't make any sense at all. Grown adult who knows he's breaking the law gets 6 months. A kid who didn't apparently know gets 2 years. That really would, for him, could right. translate into the difference of millions and millions of dollars for his ability to earn a living.
Josh, I'm glad you called. Michael Watson, give me your take on Sylvia DeSosa, the player we're talking about here. He can't play this next year either.
It's terrible. It's terrible. And I agree with the caller, and I'm thankful for his point and what he's saying. And it's just like marijuana. Marijuana used to be a felony. Now it's illegal. You know what I mean? So you have to change with the times, and you have to even go out, you know, and back, you know, kind of backtrack of what this guy is being punished of, especially if he didn't know anything about it. He didn't personally receive any payments, but he's having to be punished for it. It's like punishing the guys when they have a sanction for the NCAA and you strip or take away scholarships from the football team and people who had nothing to do with the people, you know, who actually did the crime in the beginning. It's the rules that have to change now, and this will be one of the things that'll happen because of it.
What's going to happen to DeSosa as you look down the road, Chad? Any hope for him to play this next year? I know he's declared for the NBA draft, but he may or may not be picked.
Oh, I mean, my sports guys would be better to comment on that than I do. But, I mean, we're waiting for a hearing, waiting for a ruling from a different group of the NCAA. So the NCAA has made one decision that is the 2-year suspension. And then a separate group that is a subcommittee of an NCAA will hear it and could overrule that or could modify it and say, you know, no, you know, what you've set out already is suffice or not. It's anybody's guess how they'll rule on that. Anybody that says they know how they're going to rule on it's really probably not being honest about that.
I agree.
Chad, I want to go back to the point of your recent story in the Journal World about all this, raising the question of how KU and Adidas will avoid a future scandal in the wake of this latest contract extension. You've said you're not getting clear answers on this. The athletic director for KU, Jeff Long, told reporters this, and I'm quoting, "We have commitments from Adidas to work with us to help change the nature of college basketball." What does that mean? Change the nature of college basketball, Chad?
Well, and I mean, even more particular, what are the commitments? I mean, if they've made commitments, let's just say what they are. Are there specific steps that Adidas is going to take? I suppose changing the nature of college basketball means that we're going to quit paying recruits. But, if not, then we're just kind of talking around the edges, right?
But again, as we sit here today, you don't have any direct answers from the athletic program over there as to how they're going to respond to this contract extension with KU in terms of curtailing future illegal activity.
And what we don't have is, I mean, the chancellor, we did get the chancellor to acknowledge that some changes have been made within the athletic department as it relates to some of the things they found about this, but they haven't said what they are. The question that really got us going on this latest story that we did was, how's a fellow like TJ Gasnola, he's one of the other Adidas executives that got that's been convicted. This man, all you had to do is just look. I mean, it was out there that, you know, in 2012, the NCAA banned his team from participating in several AAU tournaments because they had evidence that he had an improper relationship with an NBA agent. Mm-hmm. The man's admitted to being a bookmaker in the past. And this guy, we know now through the trials, have a lot of contact with Coach Self, has had a lot of contact with the recruits. How does KU allow somebody like that to get so close to something so valuable, which is the men's basketball program? And we haven't really heard what's changed or their analysis of how that happened.
Michael, as we wrap this up, what would be your expectation of officials over at the University of Kansas in terms of stepping forward and addressing this question that Chad is raising so effectively here, which is how should KU respond in the wake of this new shoe contract in terms of curtailing future illegal activities.
They don't have to, and they're showing you that right now with their response. They're saying things have been changed, and that will be their answer. They're not going to outline.
They're not going to specify.
They're not going to specify because they don't have to. They're too big, and so when you're too big, you can't fail. You're allowed to re-up with the same company that got you in trouble. You re-up for $196 million. That shows you what they really think about what we think. And the glory of college basketball, there would be no glory of college basketball for KU, for Michigan, if you didn't have players or recruits who were paid to go there. I mean, you have guys like Jalen Rose who speak on it, you know, and they're out. Like, heck yeah, we got a lot of money to go to Michigan. We got a lot of money. You think those guys back in the day, I'm not going to name names because I don't know specifically, but you think those guys who went through KU wasn't getting taken care of, didn't get paid to go there, and wasn't getting taken care of while they were there? It's just not going to happen, especially back in the day when you had to stay 3 and 4 years and you're becoming a prize recruit and you're becoming a prize NBA potential. Yeah, somebody's taking care of you, the donors, the backers. Somebody's taking care of you, and you're foolish if you don't believe that that's happened at your university, whichever it may be.
That's going to be our last word on this topic this morning. That's Michael Watson. He's the founder of Mentality, host of The W Show on ESPN Radio. Michael, always good to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Chad Lawhorn is publisher and editor of the Lawrence Journal World, who's been writing about this. Chad, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with a woman who has spent 28 years serving as a dispatcher for the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department on the 911 system. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tuesday on the show, we talk with the founder of the mentorship program that addresses the challenges that Kansas City's young black males face. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, levees are meant to protect land and property from rising waters, but can they actually make flooding worse? Find out how tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, for the last 28 years, Carrie Brown has been the voice on the other end of the 911 call, or has worked to dispatch Kansas City, Missouri police officers to the scenes of crimes. And yes, that's an unusually long time for anybody to work in such a high-stress field. Over time, she's learned to try hard not to take home the stresses of a long day at the office. As you're about to hear, some days are frantic. It's call after call after call. Other days are slower. Certain crimes tend to occur during daytime. Others tend to come at night. Carrie Brown, again, is a 28-year dispatcher for the KCPD. She's began working for the department at age 18 as both a call taker and a dispatcher. And Carrie, so nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
What's the difference between a call taker and a dispatcher? Because there's a key difference here.
The call takers actually talk to the citizens. They answer 911 or transfer citizens to EMS or fire when they call in. And the dispatchers are responsible for sending officers on the calls, and we handle anything that the officers need, such as if they need us to order EMS or order fire, we do that for them. We also order tows for them, or if they need assistance.
Tow trucks, you're saying?
Tow trucks, yes.
Not like T-O-E-S.
No.
Yeah, okay. But so you're saying call takers answer the 911 phone calls and dispatchers talk to the officers then,
that
basically.
Is correct.
Yeah. Is one job better paid than the other?
Actually, dispatchers get paid more than, well, actually now when they hire you on, you're hired as an actual dispatcher because they want everyone cross-trained. So if you're hired now, you get the same pay as a dispatcher because they want you cross-trained.
You know, you've landed on the dispatching end of the system, talking to the officers each day and getting them situated. Why have you gravitated that way?
Well, I'm glad that I gravitated that way because I like to help the officers. I like to be there for them.
You consider them like family.
I do consider them my family, and I like to say that we protect them, send them help when they need it. Whereas if you're talking to the citizens and you're dealing with the citizens, and that's a stressful job also.
Which one's more stressful? Because I would think that responding to the 911 calls when citizens make those calls, that's got to be where the heavy stress is.
Not necessarily. I think both jobs are, I couldn't tell you which one was more stressful because it depends on what type of call you're taking.
Right.
Obviously, if you're talking to someone whose family member was just critically injured, then yes, that's very stressful. And they're usually screaming in the phone. And of course, we're trying to ask them several questions and try to get suspect information and things like that. And at that moment, you really don't want to answer those questions. But as the dispatch side, we're sending our officers to that location and they may run into the suspect or they may see someone running. So if we have a description, we need that information from the citizens.
Right. I'm just wondering, how does it work, you know, when a panicked citizen calls in and let's just say that they might be saying that someone's trying to break into my house. As the call taker, how quickly do you get a dispatcher involved to actually get officers sent to that scene?
Well, as soon as the call taker talks to the citizen, they get all the information that they can. They send it over to dispatch. And if we have officers available, we send on it as immediately as we can.
So there's the questions, you'll ask those questions and get the information you need before a dispatcher is brought in to actually send officers to the scene.
Correct. We need all the information we can get before we send the officers. We don't want to send our officers into an unknown situation. So if there's somebody that's armed with a weapon or something like that, we need to know that information before we send our officers in there.
I bet people who are listening right now are all thinking, boy, this is a tough job. You know, and you've had experiences like this where you're answering 911 calls and literally someone is at the door trying to get into the house. Walk us through that. How do you maintain your calm in a desperate moment like that?
Well, I know in a situation like that, I have to remain calm for the citizen that's on the phone. And obviously, if we're both high strung, then we're not going to get anywhere. So my job is to try and calm that person down, help them, try to come up with something to do, tell them to hide in a closet or, you know, anything that we can think of for them to do until the officers get there.
Hmm. Tell us about that one call. I know our producer talked to you about a time when you're on the phone with someone and you can hear someone trying to break into the house.
Yes, I was on the phone with a lady, and as we were talking, someone was breaking into her house. This is in the beginning of my career when this happened. Someone was trying to break into her house, and I was telling her to try and hide in a closet. I asked her, you know, she could stop talking, and I stayed on the phone with her. I was going to stay on the phone with her until the officers got there, and then I heard gunshots in the background.
Hmm. Had she been hit?
Yes.
Yeah. It's been 27, 28 years since that call came in, I gather, and here you are still remembering it. So it clearly made an impact on you.
Yes, it made an impact on me. Some calls that you take, you can't forget about.
Yeah.
For myself, it tends to be calls that I take involving children that really bother me a lot, that I don't forget about.
How could they not?
Yes.
You know, yeah. Well, when something like that call occurs and you're on the line with someone who suffers, that the outcome is tragic, I took it. How do you manage your own emotions for the rest of the shift, for the rest of the week? And you got to go home to, I don't know if you have a family or not, but you got to go home and deal with it.
A lot of times now we have something in place to where you can get up from the console, go take a break. At the time that this happened, we didn't have that. We just continued to take calls and you just have to go on because there's more people that need your help. But now we are able to get up from the console, go walk around, take a little break, and then come back and get back to the next caller.
But even that doesn't offer you much of a break, much of a respite from the tensions that you're dealing with.
No, it doesn't. And a lot of times we take our job home with us. My kids can tell when I've had a bad day because I'll usually go in my room, shut my door, try to unwind a little bit, and I don't want to take the stress out on them, so I'll just go be in the room by myself. But they can tell when I've had a stressful day.
How do you take out the stress? How do you do that? You got a punching bag in your house?
No.
Yeah.
No, I just try to lay down, relax, watch a little TV.
Yeah, just chill.
Yes.
Well, I can't help but wonder, you've been doing this for 28 years. How unusual is that?
It's very unusual. We have a high turnover rate. I love my job. I can't imagine myself doing anything else, although I know that day will come. But yes, I can't imagine myself doing anything else.
Well, I mean, why not? It's such a hard job.
I'm a very laid back person, and I like to say that I handle my stress very well. And it doesn't tend to stress me out as much as it does some other people.
You can remove yourself from the situation a little bit?
I can.
Mm-hmm.
I can. Sometimes such as nurses, when they have death in their field, they kind of remove themselves from the situation, and it's something that you have to deal with on a daily basis. And same with our job, we have to deal with this on a daily basis. So you kind of get used to the situation. Not that we like to feel that way, but you just kind of get used to it. And I guess that's what I've done.
I bet your bosses would like to come to you, Carrie Brown, and sort of bottle up whatever it is, that sort of calm sense you bring to your position, bottle that and sell it to other dispatchers.
Well, I think to do this job, you have to be a calm person. If you're a very high-strung person, you're probably not going to last very long in this profession.
Yeah. Does the department tend to hire people who are calmer than not?
No, that I don't know. I don't know how they do the employment or how they screen people for the hiring process. But if you're very high strung, I would probably say you're not going to be around KCPD too long.
I was going to say, do you sometimes look at the new hires and think you meet them and you look at them and you think, this person's not going to last. This isn't going to work.
Sometimes you can tell.
You got to admit it, right?
Yes. Sometimes you can tell, but sometimes you get fooled and they do last. So you just never know.
Carrie Brown is my guest. She has been on the other end of 911 calls for 28 years for the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. If you want to join our conversation, our number here is 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, take us into the dispatch room on, I'm guessing, a busy weekend night when the calls are really coming in. That's got to be tense. Describe it to me.
It is very tense and it's very stressful. Sometimes we don't have cars available in a certain zone, so we have to ship our calls to a different zone. So there's a lot of talking and I don't want to say yelling, but talking to, we have Center Zone, East Zone, Metro, North, and Shoal Creek are our zones. And so when
Center, East, and Metro are sort of the central city patrol districts that were around even when I was covering the department back in the 80s. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So if we don't have a car in Center Zone, we may ship it to the closest zone available that has a car in service. So you're talking back and forth to that dispatcher, and then you may have the helicopter. Somebody may need the helicopter, so you're yelling out in the room, I need 690.
690 is the helicopter?
690 is the helicopter. So there's a lot of talking going on, and you have to be able to multitask. You have to be able to talk on the radio, answer your phone, listen to what's going on around the room. If another officer in another zone needs help and they don't have any cars, then we have to send cars to assist them. So there's a lot going on in that room.
I'm wondering what the feeling is like when a citizen has called 911 and you don't have any officers available to dispatch to them. Because a lot of people still assume, I think, that you call 911 and someone's going to answer and the police will be there in about 18 seconds. And it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. In a perfect world, we would love for it to work that way.
Yeah.
But you also have to remember that they have driving time and the officer that we're sending may be 15 minutes away from you. So we try to send the closest officer available. But sometimes when you're in a crisis, you don't understand that they have driving time and it takes them a while to get there.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Cindy from Kansas City, Kansas, you're on with Carrie Brown, a 28-year veteran of the 911 Emergency Call Center for the KCPD. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to tell her congratulations for 28 years. That's a long time. I know I've been doing it for 13, and it's rough. It's hard. People yell at you. They scream at you. It's hard. So good job.
when people yell at you, Cindy, or that's the people who are calling in, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where did you do your own dispatching?
I'm in Kansas. I'm like, I don't really want to say, but
okay,
Kansas.
You're on the Kansas side of the state line. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the hardest part of the job for you, Cindy? I'm sorry. Oh, I lost her. Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What is the toughest part of the job, Carrie?
Well, sometimes as a dispatcher, as a call taker, you don't get an ending to the call. So the officers actually find out what happened at the end, but sometimes we go home wondering how the situation ended.
Mm-hmm.
So not knowing, I guess, would be a hard part of the job.
So you're sort of left hanging there.
Yes.
Is there a way for you to find out?
Yes, we probably could the next day when we go back to work. But a lot of times, but you take so many calls that sometimes you can't remember the address to a location. And it's hard to, once you go back to work, you try to forget everything. So
yeah,
you may not want to look it up.
Okay. Let's go to Mark from Midtown, who's a former police officer. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Just called to say that Carrie Brown is a class act, the best they come, and I just wanted her to know that officers and former officers support her work and her long tenure there. And I'd just like to say, hey, offer our support.
Mark, what makes her so good?
Oh man, just calm on the fire, always there to support us in the field. Class act. I mean, I think you said it earlier. You can bottle her up and create other communication support staff, and you would have a top notch communications department. So,
Mark, how does she support the officers in the field? Translate that for me. What does that mean?
So, you know, there's a lot of things that she would know prior to an officer actually knowing. You know, she probably would know the scene, the scenario, the situation prior to us knowing, and getting that conveyed to the officer that's responding is quite important. You know, being able to know details that will help the officer and offer that information without even asking or being requested. I mean, they are highly trained professionals, but, you know, sometimes you get one that's just extra special, and that's the route it is. So
yeah,
just wanted to say that.
Mark, you're so nice to call in. I really appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. What do you want your officers to know before they enter a home, for instance? How much information are you trying to get them?
Trying to get them everything that they need. I don't want them to go into a dangerous situation. Of course, they're supposed to be aware every call that they take. But if I have some information that I need them to know, I try to go the extra mile, make sure that I'll do some research. I like to call myself a little private investigator. I'll do some additional research that sometimes we're not required to do. But
for
I like
instance,
to,
like what?
Well, if there's a party at the address that possibly has a warrant, I'll try to go a little bit further to make sure they have all the warrant information to the address. If there's a previous call there, I'll check the previous call to make sure that they have all the information. And if there was a gun involved in a previous address or call at that location, I'll let them know.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, do you know these officers? I mean, you work on the radio. If you bumped into one 2 hours after your shift is over, would you know who they are?
No, not all of them. Some of them I personally know because we've actually met, but there's a couple of officers that I'm very close to, and I've never seen them before in my life.
Just because you've been talking to them on the radio for years?
Yes.
Wouldn't you like to meet them?
Yes, I would like to meet them.
Yeah.
I would.
Because you have this pretty intense relationship going on, you know, obviously professional, but it's pretty intense.
We do. And sometimes when you do meet them, you're like, whoa, I never imagined them to look like that.
People say that about me sometimes. Yeah,
yes, because you just know their voice.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to some calls. Kim from Lansing. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, Carrie. I've taken several ladies' self-defense pistol classes and also been in classes given by U.S. Law Shield. And we've been told that if there's a self-defense shooting, you give the dispatcher or the call taker basic information, your name, your location, do I need ambulance, police, what do I need, what am I wearing so that I'm not mistaken for the bad guy, but then hang up. And we were told, I've been told numerous times that the call takers will attempt to keep you on the phone and obtain additional information, but we've been advised not to continue the conversation because what we're going to be saying, excuse me, in a stressful situation is going to be taken out of context, held against us. I'm wondering, are you guys trained to keep people on the phone? And if so, what's the reason?
Yeah. Thanks, Kim.
Well, obviously I'm not an attorney, so I can't advise you what to do, but we do need you to stay on the line and answer all of our questions, just because we're looking out also for the safety of our officers. So we do need to get all the information that we can for the safety of our officers and also for the safety of you, because there could be someone else or there could be another suspect that you don't know about. So we definitely need to get all of the information that we can. And we need all of our questions answered.
Let's go back to some calls. Mickey from Gladstone. Mickey, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm starting to cry. Saturday night, I was one of those hysterical 911 callers. And we witnessed a really horrific motorcycle accident on Shoto about Front Street.
I'm sorry.
It was just the two of us. We stopped, of course, and I called 911. I was hysterical, and I always thought of myself as a calm, cool person until something like that happens. And the person who took my call managed to get information out of me, calmed me down. It was only minutes, really, before emergency showed up. I just want to thank you.
She says it sounded like you might have been that person who took her call. Does that ring a bell with you, Carrie?
No, that doesn't ring a bell with
me. Yeah, it might have been somebody else. Mickey, I'm glad you called. And I should just say, you know, you have such a calm demeanor. A lot of guests in here, they're jiggling their feet or jiggling their hands, moving their fingers. You're just sitting there as calm as can be as we have this conversation. I get the sense pretty clearly that you're a pretty calm dispatcher.
Yes, I am.
Well, Carrie, thanks for coming in and congratulations on 28 years.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me in.
Again, that's Carrie Brown, a dispatcher for the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Tomorrow on the show, one of the nation's first social service agencies for Latinos, we look at 100 years of the Guadalupe Center helping Kansas City's West Side community. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.